All right, everyone. Again, this is the 2023 Mid-Atlantic Christadelphian Bible School. Our second speaker is Brother David Wisniewski of Livonia, Michigan Ecclesia. His topic for the week, Developing Spiritual Intelligence from the Life of David. And today's subject is honor. Brother David.
Thanks, Brother Bob, and good morning, everyone. Is everyone excited to go to the lake today? Yeah? Cool. Excellent. Good, so you have something to look forward to. Lake, and it's sunny, it's not raining. Wouldn't it be a bummer if there was a thunderstorm out there? Pardon? I'll say no more. Well, we looked first at Jonathan, and we saw a man who could inspire spiritual greatness. We looked secondly at David, and we saw a man with great clarity in terms of seeing things as God saw them, loving righteousness and hating wickedness. And so although all Israel was running away from Goliath, there was David pronouncing what he really was, somebody that had defied the armies of God. And today we come to Saul. Why do we want to look at Saul? It's a bit of a bummer to look at Saul, to be honest. We've probably seen that in our readings over the past week as we've been going through 1 Samuel, from 9 through to where we're at now in our Bible readings today in chapter 17. Because Saul is definitely not a man that we would look to as a positive example. But our subject today is honor. We're going to see that both Jonathan, a man who could inspire spiritual greatness in others, and David, with supreme clarity of discernment, spiritual discernment, yet both would hold this pitiful man in honor. So let's spend the majority of our class then understanding just how pathetic this man Saul was. His name means to desire or to beg, which is interesting because he was desired by the nation, wasn't he? They desired to have a king over Israel like the nations did. They wanted a king like the nations. They wanted a king after their own heart. At first, remember, Samuel was offended when they asked for a king, but God put things into perspective when he told Samuel, "Hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but have rejected me, that I should not reign over them." And so it says in Hosea chapter 13, "Of Saul I gave thee a king in mine anger." I gave thee a king in mine anger. Hosea 13, verse 11. He gave them the king that they wanted, the king they desired. He gave them a king like the nations, a king after their own heart. Well, we considered the introduction to Jonathan. We considered yesterday the introduction to David, four introductions of David, right? And today we'll consider the introductions to Saul. The first one is the divine record. So in this, we see a man who was a very handsome young man. We turn to 1 Samuel chapter 9 at verse 3. At verse 2, it says that there was a man of Benjamin, a mighty man. His name was Kish. He had a son whose name was Saul, a choice young man, a goodly. There was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. For the word choice young man, Vine states he was a vigorous young man who was unmarried. Goodly is actually there twice. It means better or beautiful. But how is he introduced? Verse 3. And the asses of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. There's the divine introduction to Saul. He had lost his father's asses, his father's donkeys. How was David introduced? He was tending his father's sheep, was one of the introductions. And here's Saul, who's lost his father's herd. And of course, asses or donkeys was a symbol of what in the scriptures? It was a symbol of Israel. What a contrast to David, who even in his absence, when he came down to see his brothers at the battle, took care of his father's sheep. Remember what his brother said to him when he saw David? because he felt threatened by David's presence, because David had been anointed and he'd been passed over. He said, "What are you doing down here? Get back to those few sheep in the wilderness." But David had already taken care of his father's sheep. The second thing we read about him is that he has no idea who Samuel is. Verse 6 of 1 Samuel 9, "And he said unto him, This is the servant of Saul, says unto him, Behold now, there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man." And later on in the chapter, when Saul asks where he can find Samuel, we find he's actually asking Samuel. Samuel is unknown to Saul. We see that at verse 18 of 1 Samuel 9. "Then Saul drew near to Samuel in the gate and said, Tell me, I pray thee, where the seer's house is. And Samuel answered Saul, I am the seer." He had no idea who the man of God was. He had lost his father's herd. This was the type of man that Israel wanted to be a king, because he was head and shoulders above everyone else, and because he was good to look upon. Well, the first time he's introduced to all Israel is over the chapter in 1 Samuel chapter 10 at verse 20. Verse 19, Samuel says to the children of Israel, "Ye have this day rejected yourself, who himself saved you out of all your adversities and your tribulations, and you said unto him, No, set a king up over us. Now therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your thousands." And in verse 20, Samuel causes all the tribes of Israel to come near, and then he selects the tribe of Benjamin. And then in verse 21, when he causes the tribe of Benjamin to stand forward, he separates by their family, and he goes to the family of Matri, and then to Kish, and to Saul. But when they go to introduce Saul as the new king over Israel, he can't be found. Verse 22, "Therefore they inquired of the Lord further if the man should yet come hither. And Yahweh answers, Behold, he's hiding amongst the stuff." There was the man that the children of Israel chose. Well, he was head and shoulders above all the other people in verse 23. "And they all cheer, even though he was hiding amongst the stuff. God save the king." Not a great introduction, either one of them. In one, lost his father's herd, doesn't know the man of God. In the other, as he's being introduced as the king, he's hiding. And when he finally stands up and they see he's tall and he's handsome, the nation cheers. But here's the thing. God does not set us up for failure. God does not set us up for failure. When we fail, it's entirely our fault. And even though this man was a loser spiritually and a loser in life, hiding behind the stuff, God gave him every opportunity to succeed. So take a look at 1 Samuel chapter 10 at verse 9. "And it was so that when Saul turned his back to go from Samuel, God gave him another heart. And all those signs came to pass that day that Samuel had prophesied." In fact, it then says at verse 10, "And when they came hither to the hill, behold, a company of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God came upon him, and he prophesied upon them. And this was so strange that at verse 12, some said, Is Saul also among the prophets? Because now all of a sudden Saul was speaking spiritually. And this was so foreign from what usually came out of Saul's mouth that the people were astounded. But see, God is setting Saul up for success here. He first sends him to Samuel. And in those discussions, God started to soften Saul's heart. And then he puts his spirit upon him. He gives him the power of the Holy Spirit so he's able to prophesy, which was foreign to him, but God is setting up him for success. We come down to verse 26, we read, "And Saul also went home to Gibeah." He doesn't go and establish a throne. He doesn't establish a place of worship. But God's still setting him up for success. "And there went with him a band of men whose hearts God had touched." And so, God was giving Saul every opportunity to succeed. You know, God does the same thing in our lives, brothers and sisters and young people. He gives us every opportunity to succeed. For some of us, He might have put us into a home with Christadelphian parents who were trying their hardest to live a life in the truth. Now, you live with your parents, so you'll see the mistakes and the hypocrisy like my children would see in my family. But you also see people that are trying to do what's right and penitent when they do what's wrong. And so you too have been given opportunity to succeed. Maybe you have just one parent in the truth. You still have someone trying to help you come to a knowledge of the truth. You've been brought out to Sunday school or in youth groups. You've been given opportunity to make friends in the truth. You're being given opportunities to succeed. But sadly, Saul, when he returns back to his own home, does nothing. He's been announced the king of Israel. He's got a band of men that God has stirred up to be with him. He's been given a new heart. He's been given the power of the Holy Spirit. He was able to prophesy, and then he goes home and sits down on his couch, as if nothing happened. And so God stirs him into action in chapter 11 by bringing the Ammonites up against them. Verse 1 of chapter 11, then Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh Gilead, and all the men of Jabesh said, we will make a covenant with thee. And in verse 2, they say, okay, here's the basis of the covenant. Just poke out your right eye and give us your right eyeballs, and then we'll make a covenant with you. So you'll all be blind in one eye. God's provoking Saul to action because Saul is doing nothing. Again, there's every opportunity to succeed that's being given here. Furthermore, in verse 6, it says, and the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard these tidings, and he was angered. His anger was greatly kindled. And he takes the yoke of oxen, the animals. He cuts those animals up into 12 pieces. He sends their pieces throughout the tribe through horse riders, kind of gross, bloody pieces of these carcasses of these two animals that he's cut up into 6 pieces each, as a message to rally all Israel together. Why does he do that? Well, that had actually happened once before, specifically to the tribe of Benjamin, when a woman had been hideously murdered, and all Israel had come together on evidence of what had happened to her. And so he remembers this and takes these two oxen and cuts them into pieces and sends it to all, and all the nation comes together. All the nation comes together. Sadly, Saul, although he had a victory at this time, and although there were those that did not come up and support him, verse 12, and the people said unto Samuel, who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death. And Saul spares them that day. In verse 13, there shall not be a man put to death today, for the Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel. Remember that response that Saul had at this battle. Because there were those that didn't want Saul to be king when he'd been announced king. Perhaps they saw the reality of what this guy was like, that he was a loser on all counts. And Saul is willing to spare them from death because Yahweh had wrought salvation for Israel. They had defeated the Ammonites. They were scattered so that not two of them were left together. Unfortunately, it seems that Saul becomes consumed in the things that he has done. He becomes consumed in self-aggrandizement. So remember this, brothers and sisters and young people, are you in a position of authority? CYC president or events coordinator? Maybe in your school, in a school council, in university? When you get older, in the ecclesia, you're just a servant. Remember that you're just a servant and you're doing what you're doing for God's glory and not your own. Well, when we come to 1 Samuel chapter 13, Saul is now 40 years old. and he had reigned for 2 years. And we remember the account as we went through the story in the life of Jonathan, don't we? Jonathan, with his 1,000, had gone up and he had beaten a garrison of the Philistines. And we saw that all Israel heard say in verse 4 that Saul had smitten a garrison of the Philistines. So he takes credit for Jonathan's victory. 330,000 men had known of his victory over the Ammonites. That's how many had come together to that battle. Now he only has 2,000 soldiers and Jonathan 1,000. He's got an army that's less than 1% of the size. But people have forgotten about his victory with the Ammonites. And so he uses the opportunity of Jonathan's win and Jonathan's victory to prop himself up again. And then we saw, didn't we, that the Philistines gather against Israel. He loses his position as the Philistines advance into Israel. And we saw Saul's leadership at verse 6 of 1 Samuel 13. When the people of Israel saw they were in a strait, for the people were distressed, then the people did hide themselves, and some of them fled across the Jordan River. There's the result, brothers and sisters and young people, of non-inspiring leadership. I mean, contrast this with Jonathan, who says to one man, let's go climb a cliff and beat up an army of 100,000 Philistines. And yet, here's Saul's leadership. And that man, of course, we saw, said, let's do it. Everything that's in your heart, I'm game for. And here's Saul's leadership. They're in a strait. They're distressed. They hide. They went over Jordan. And though in my Bible, I've got those highlighted in red, those action words. In a strait, distressed, hidden, and fled over Jordan. That was what the leadership of Saul resulted in. We remember then that Saul was now in Gilgal, and that he had remembered that Samuel had told him, when you arrive in Gilgal, and when the Philistines have assembled against you, wait 7 days, and I will come and bring the sacrifice. And we considered how Saul grows impatient at the end of the 7th day. And he goes and he offers the sacrifice himself at verse 9 of 1 Samuel 13. And at verse 11, Samuel challenges him as we saw, what have you done? And let's look at the reason that Samuel gives. Can I have a volunteer, please, to read verses 11 and 12 of 1 Samuel 13? Yes, right here. Did Samuel ask Saul, what did the soldiers do that made you do this, Saul? Did Samuel ask Saul, what did I do that made you do this, Saul? Did Samuel ask Saul, what did the Philistines do that made you do this, Saul? Did Samuel ask Saul, what were you worried about that made you do this, Saul? No. But what's Saul's reason for why he disobeyed the commandment of Samuel? My soldiers were leaving. He blamed the soldiers. You didn't come when you were supposed to. He blamed Samuel. The Philistines were gathered at Michmash. He blamed the Philistines. I was worried they would attack me. I'm worried about my well-being. And I hadn't offered a sacrifice to ask for the Lord's help, so I forced myself to do it. Is there any accountability that Saul takes for his own actions? No. He's more than willing to take accountability for the good actions of Jonathan and his victory, but takes no accountability for his own actions. It's so obvious, we don't even need to state the principle, do we? Take responsibility for your own actions. Even if there was peer pressure that resulted in you doing it, even if circumstances presented themselves in such a situation that caused you or influenced you to do it, take responsibility for what you've done. Acknowledge what you've done and take responsibility with an intent to change so that you don't make the same mistake in the future. When you don't take responsibility for what you've done, what doesn't happen in your life? Character development doesn't happen when we don't take responsibility for our own actions. And so we read in our first class, Samuel says to Saul, "Now would the Lord have established thy kingdom forever. Again, he had every opportunity to succeed, but now thy kingdom shall not continue." Now we may say, wait a minute, the kingship was supposed to go to another tribe. Does anybody remember what tribe was supposed to have the kingship over Israel, over the 12 tribes? Yes, Judah. Anybody remember, harder question, where that was first stated, that the kingship would be in Judah? It was in the blessings that Jacob gave to his 12 sons. When he comes to Judah, he says, "The scepter shall never depart." That rod of rulership would never depart from the tribe of Judah. Does that mean God was contradicting himself? No, God has stated in the scriptures, even if I pronounce a judgment that I'm going to make against a nation, and the nation changes their behavior, then I'll change the judgment that I've done. Even though God had pronounced the scepter would never depart from Judah, which he could say out of his foreknowledge, he had every intention to allow Saul's family to remain on that throne forever. He said it, and God does not lie. So the opportunity was there. He'd given him every opportunity to succeed. A new heart, Samuel, the power of the Holy Spirit, men that were sympathetic to him, that rallied around him. He gave him the Spirit again when the Ammonites came up against them. He gave him a son who was spiritual, who could have been that positive influence. And where do you think Jonathan developed that spiritual perspective in that family? Did it come from Saul? No. Obviously, Saul's mother was a spiritual woman. And we know that because later, Saul will attribute Jonathan's love for David and siding with David, he'll attribute it to his mother, to Jonathan's mother. And so he had a spiritual wife, he had a spiritual son, he had a spiritual seer, a counselor, he had the power of the Holy Spirit given to him, he had a band of men that God had inspired to be around him, and God told him, "You had the opportunity to be on the throne forever." God knew, though, what decisions Saul would make and what that kingship would lead to. Well, remember Saul's reaction then to finding out that the kingdom had been rent from Saul. It's between verses 14 and 15. Take a look in your Bibles. Look at verse 14 and verse 15. Does anybody see there the reaction of Saul to Samuel saying that his kingdom was rent from his hand? It's a trick question. There's nothing there. It doesn't tell us anything. It's like Saul's not even fazed by the fact that the kingdom had been rent from his family because it didn't affect him personally. We're going to contrast that with what happens when Samuel comes and rends the kingdom from his hand. His hand. All right, then we come to 1 Samuel chapter 14, and we saw that Jonathan had snuck away from his father while his father was tarrying under a pomegranate tree, as far away from the Philistines as he could possibly be. And then we remember the account in Jonathan that he and his armor bearer had gone against the entire army, and that God met the faith, the conviction, and the action based on faith of Jonathan with an earthquake, and that all the army started to flee before them. God was giving them the victory, just like God had given them the victory in the battle against the Ammonites. And what does Saul do? Well, verse 24 of 1 Samuel 14 tells us what Saul did. "And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had sworn, had made the people swear, Cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening, that I might be avenged of mine enemies. So none of the people had anything to eat. Well, how many of you have fought in a battle before with a sword and a spear? Oh, we got one? Presumably it was a play. It wasn't literal. Yeah, but if you were actually fighting in a battle, this is actually life and death. It's not who's going to cross the 100-meter finish line first or the 100-yard finish line first. It's not who's going to throw the shot put the furthest. It's actually if you don't stand and fight and flail your sword around and try to cut the other person in front of you, you'll be dead. And you think it might take a little bit of energy to pick a sword up and to swing it and to try to avoid being killed yourself and to be running after people? You're running, you're swinging the sword around, you're holding a spear as you're fighting all day. And Saul says, nobody gets to eat anything until I'm avenged of my enemies. What unbelievable poor leadership. If he hadn't been so rash and so selfish, there would have been a magnificent victory that day. And so when we come back a little bit to see, that was the condition of the army because of Saul's rash vow. But when Saul sees the multitude melt away at verse 16, that they're beating each other down as they're running because they assume that the earthquake is actually a massive army that's coming up against them, because they've seen those 20 men being killed and falling off the edge of the cliff, and now there's this massive shaking of the ground, and they assume that's just the precursor to a massive army that's going to come against them, and now they're all fleeing in such chaos that they're killing people, thinking it's the Israelites beside them, and it's actually their own people. And Saul, at the distance, can see all this happening. And he says to the people, go get them. Actually, no, he doesn't. At verse 17, he says, number now and see who's gone from us. Are you serious? The Philistines that have caused everybody to tremble, that have reduced your army to 600 people, and that those 600 people are carrying rakes instead of swords as weapons, with only two swords left in the land, Jonathan's and Saul's, and now they're all running away, and while they're running away, they're killing each other while they're running away. And the first thing Saul says when he sees all this is, go figure out who's missing. Unbelievable. Absolute foolishness. Not a spiritual bone in this man's body. Should we pray when we're going to make a major decision? Well, certainly we should pray. But was there a decision that was needed at this point in time? No, because another man had already made a prayer, and he'd already asked for a sign, and God had given that sign, and he'd already acted upon it. At this point in time, there was nothing more that needed to be done than to go and chase after them. It says at verse 17, when they numbered, they found that Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. Does he say, oh great, my son started all this, let's go? No. Bring forth the ark. Bring the ark? Now you're going to wait. The Philistines are running away, beating each other down as they run away. And you're going to wait for them to go grab the ark. It wasn't that far away because it was at Gibeah. Grab the ark and to bring it along with the priest. It says in verse 19, it came to pass while Saul talked unto the priest that the noise in the host of the Philistine went on and increased. So he's telling the priest, look, can you please do the Urim and the Thummim? Remember, the priest had before him, this was Abiathar the priest, had on his chest the breastplate with the 12 stones representing the 12 tribes of Israel. And inside the pouch that held the breastplate, there were two stones called the Urim and the Thummim. And that was like casting lots that they did in the New Testament. And based on the stone that they pulled out, it reflected the decision that God had made. So he calls the priest. He doesn't approach God in prayer. He calls the priest forward and he says, let's do the Urim and the Thummim. And the priest has his hand inside. Should we chase after them or not? And Saul's turning around because the army's running away. And Saul says, oh, forget about it. Let's just go. So he's wasted all of that time. Withdraw thine hand, he says at verse 19. He's wasted all the time to get the ark there, to get the priest there, to get the priest with the Urim and the Thummim to explain what he wants. He's asked for God's decision. The priest puts his hand in the breastplate to pull out the Urim and the Thummim to reveal God's decision. And he says, you know what, forget about it. We need to go. I mean, you can't get a more ridiculous description of a person's leadership. And so he finally assembles the army of people that haven't eaten all day. And he tells them to go start chasing the Philistines. And so we read at verse 23, so Yahweh saved Israel that day, and the battle passed over unto Beth-haven. They could have eliminated them that day. They weren't eliminated. How do we know that? Because a few chapters later, Goliath is in the middle of a valley, and on one side of the valley is the army of the Philistines again. They could have annihilated the army of the Philistines if this man had any sense, but he'd starved his soldiers. And now he regathers the soldiers and his army. The soldiers were so hungry, actually, it says that they start to dive, verse 32, they dive upon the animals that are left behind by the Philistine army, and they start eating raw flesh. That's how hungry these soldiers were. That's kind of gross. Although I have eaten tuna tartare, and it was pretty good. But it has citrus put on top, so it's not quite raw. But in this case, they literally were cutting open the animals and just eating the meat raw, because of Saul's poor leadership. And they tell Saul in verse 33, behold, the people sin against the Lord, and that they eat with the blood. And he said, you've transgressed. And he asked for a stone to be rolled, and he brings animal sacrifices in verse 33, and he slays all the animals, and he does a proper way of presenting these animals before God, and the people are able to eat then. And he builds an altar to the Lord at verse 35, and then he says, well, now we need to get down to some business. If I could have a volunteer to read, actually I'll ask the young man in the white shirt three tables back because he put his hand up earlier. If you could read, please, verses 36 to 38 of 1 Samuel 14. So he's asked for a sign from God properly now. Again, did he really need a sign? Should we go chase after those Philistines that have been running away from us that my son Jonathan inspired one person to go after, and now the whole nation was inspired to go after them? But he does, and when he doesn't get an answer, he says, oh, I know why there's not an answer. It has nothing to do with my incompetence. It's because somebody has sinned in breaking the commandment, the swearing that I had done this morning that nobody was allowed to eat. And so it ends up that he's willing to kill his son Jonathan in this account. And if it weren't for the army that recognizes how ludicrous the situation is, Saul would have had Jonathan put to death. Why? Because when Jonathan had beaten the garrison of the Philistines, he was able to take credit for what had been done. Was there any way to take credit for this victory? Absolutely not. He sat as far away from the army as possible. And Jonathan and his armor bearer were the only ones missing. Everybody knew the victory this day had come from Jonathan and the armor bearer. There was no way to take credit for this victory. And I think he knew it was Jonathan, because at verse 39 says, "As the Lord liveth, which saveth Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall die." And nobody answers a word. And so he calls the nation together, the chief of the people. And here's another sign that he knew it was Jonathan. He puts everyone else over there, and he puts himself and Jonathan together. And he says, "Okay, now let's do the Urim and Thummim to figure out where the sin is. Who's broken the commandment that I did?" And of course, it's with Saul and Jonathan. It says at verse 41, "And Saul and Jonathan were taken, but the people escaped. And Saul said, 'Cast lots between me and Jonathan.' Jonathan was taken. And Jonathan says to him," and I'll read this from the NIV, "'I merely tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now I must die?' And Saul says, 'May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan.' And the people stand between him and Jonathan and save Jonathan that day. He was willing to kill Jonathan because he couldn't take credit for the victory. What an unbelievable man. And so for verse 46, "And Saul went up from following the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place." So the victory was lost that day. Do you remember when the Ammonites came up against them and said, "Yeah, we'll make a covenant with you as long as you poke out your right eye"? That sounds like fun. And he beats the Ammonites. And there was that group of people that had conspired against his rulership. And when Saul has beaten the Ammonites, and he says, "Yahweh's given his victory over this army," and they say, "Well, let's put to death the people that didn't support you." He says, "No, we're not going to put someone to death today, because Yahweh's wrought a great victory in Israel." And now here the Philistines have been chased away by Jonathan and his armor bearer, and Saul's willing to kill not just anybody, not just somebody that's opposing him on his throne, but kill his own son. Well, that brings us to 1 Samuel chapter 15, where Saul had been told to kill the Amalekites. He'd been told to kill the Amalekites because of what they had done to the children of Israel. Do you remember what the Amalekites had done to the children of Israel when they wandered in the wilderness? Well, this is what they had done. While the children of Israel are wandering through the wilderness, there would be some that would straggle behind. We know who those are because we look around at Bible school and we see that some of us, like yourselves, who have much youth and energy, you can get over to the lunch hall pretty quickly, and there's other people that are walking along in a walker, or they're using a cane. And so there were stragglers in Israel as they wandered through the wilderness. And do you know what the Amalekites did? They killed them. There's that elderly person walking along, hobbling on a cane or a stick, and the Amalekites would come along and shove a sword through them. And they'd drop to the ground. Or the mothers with their small children and their baby carriages as they're trying to get everything together and pack up because the encampment of God has moved and the baby's crying and trying to get the baby on the back, and there they are, and the main encampment has already taken off and they're a little bit behind, and out the Amalekites would pop behind a rock and slice the head of the mother and the baby off. That was the Amalekites. It's a description, brothers and sisters and young people of the world, who take out the stragglers in ecclesial life. They take out the weak, the sick, and the tired, and those that lag behind. And so we should be motivated not to be a part of the weak, the sick, and the tired, and the stragglers, but to be dedicating ourselves to the truth and to the Word of God so that we can defend ourselves against the Amalekite. So God hated the Amalekites because of what they had done to Israel in the wilderness. God said, "I remember," verse 2, "that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid for wait for him in the day when they came up from Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek," was the instruction. "Utterly destroy all that they have. Spare none of them. The influence of that people will have been spread even down to the youngest of children in that nation. I want you to wipe them out for what they've done, even their animals." And we come down to verse 8. It says, They took Agag, the king of the Amorites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But, verse 9, Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen, of the fatlings, of the lambs, and all that was good, and did not utterly destroy them, but everything that was vile and refuse, garbage, that they utterly destroyed. God said this, and they, we'll do some of that. We'll do it where it fits our means and where it feels good for us. Well, Samuel comes to him because God comes to Samuel and tells him, it's repented me that I made Saul king over Israel. And so we read at verse 13, Samuel comes to Saul, and Saul says to him, blessed be thou of Yahweh, for I have performed the commandment of the Lord. And meanwhile, he's surrounded by sheep and oxen, and he's got the king of the Amalekites standing beside him. Unbelievable. And Samuel asks him, what is this bleeding? I can hear the sound of the animals. What are you talking about? And how does Saul respond to this again at verse 15? They, the people, they brought them from the Amalekites. The people spared the best of the sheep, but I've taken them and I'm going to sacrifice them to the Lord. And the rest we did utterly destroy. So we partially obeyed. And where we didn't obey, it was because we wanted to do a sacrifice. And actually, it wasn't even me. It was actually the people who did it. But I'm going to make the best of the situation, says Saul. They, the people, no responsibility for his own actions. Samuel says to Saul, stay, and I will tell thee what the Lord hath said to do. Samuel tells Saul to shut up. And then he explains that he had taken Saul from being one of the smallest tribes in Israel because they'd almost been destroyed because of the events in Judges 19 through 20. Taken him, he'd made him a king, and then he gave him a commandment. The commandment was to utterly destroy the Amalekites, and he has not obeyed. And verse 22, Samuel says, hath the Lord as great a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken is the better than rams. Where did that principle come from, to obey is better than sacrifice? Where's the first place sacrifice is introduced in the Bible? Anybody? Yes. Cain and Abel. It's actually it's the first sacrifice that a man does, but there's actually one done before that by God. And that's in the garden, right? God makes, yes. Well, that's a good, symbolically perhaps, yeah. Yeah, so God sacrificed an animal to make a covering for Adam and Eve when they tried to cover their sin with a fig leaf. So that was the first sacrifice. Why did God have to make that sacrifice? Why did God have to provide a covering for them? Because they knew they were naked, exactly. And why did they know they were naked? What had they done to expose that? They ate the fruit. They transgressed. So actually, sacrifice came about because of disobedience. Saul, to obey is better than sacrifice. And unfortunately, Saul encapsulates what they thought in the first century, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And so Saul is told that to obey is better than sacrifice. In verse 23, for the rebellion is as sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is the iniquity of idolatry, pointing forward to what Saul would do at the end of his life. Because thou hast rejected the word of the Lord has also rejected thee from being king. Now, when Saul was rejected from being his lineage, being over the kingdom, what did Saul do? Nothing. And now that Saul's rejected, what does he do? Saul says, I have sinned, I have transgressed. I did it because I feared the people and I obeyed their voice, but still, it wasn't my fault, but still, I did sin. Now pray, Samuel, pardon my sin. Turn again with me that I may worship the Lord. And Samuel says, I will not return unto thee, for thou hast rejected the word of the Lord, and he's rejected thee from being king. And as Samuel turned to go away, Saul drops to the ground, and he grabs his skirt, and he rips a piece of his skirt off. And he prays, verse 28. Samuel says, just as the Lord, you have rent off a piece of my skirt, so the Lord has rent the kingdom of Israel from thee this day and given it to a neighbor that is better than thine. And he prays, please, honor me. Verse 30, I have sinned, yet honor me now, I pray thee, before the elders of my people and before Israel. And turn again with me that I may worship the Lord thy God. Don't let me be humiliated in this way. Now that he's removed from being king, now all of a sudden he cares. Jonathan was removed, no concern. He's removed, well, now I care. And Samuel then hews Agag into pieces. And at this point in time, an evil spirit comes upon Saul. And so Saul will now grow insanely jealous of Jonathan because he knows he's been rejected from being king. And there's someone better than him that has a heart after God's own heart that is now going to become the king. And in 1 Samuel 28, we turn over now to the end of Saul's life. In 1 Samuel 28, having ended his chase of David after 10 years of chasing David, he's ended his chase. The Philistines have once again assembled against him. And it says in verse 6, and when Saul inquired of the Lord answered him not, neither by dreams, nor by Urim, nor by prophets. Of course, he put to death all the priests, except for one who escaped alive because of his rage against David. And instead of turning to God, it says that he did, but he actually did not do so in a right spirit, because whenever we turn to God, if we do so in the right spirit, God hears our prayer and will listen. So he had not the right spirit. And he went instead to a witch at verse 7. Instead of getting down on his hands and knees before God and begging God to get involved in his life, he goes to a witch. And he asked the witch to raise Samuel from the dead. And so we read in 1 Chronicles 10, verse 13, so Saul died for his transgression, which he had committed against the Lord, even against the word of the Lord, which he kept not, and also for asking counsel of one that had a familiar spirit to inquire of it, and inquired not of the Lord. But it says here he did inquire of the Lord. God says, no, he didn't inquire of the Lord. He did not have the right spirit when he came before me, a spirit of humility. Therefore, the Lord slew him and turned the kingdom unto David, the son of Jesse. Saul had spent all those years, 10 years, chasing David, rejecting God, seeking his own glory. And so he would lose his life and the life of his sons, and Israel would be given into the hand of the Philistines. Once again, Saul would have lost his father's asses. And you know, in the context of this, Jonathan decides to stay with his father. See, this conflict had arisen then between David and between Saul and the kingdom, because Saul suspected that David was the one that God had anointed to be king. We know that was the case. And he throws a spear trying to kill David. And at one point he throws a spear trying to kill Jonathan. And we might say to ourselves, why would Jonathan stay in the court with his father? Why wouldn't Jonathan go out with David? The one that he loved because of the way that David treated his father. The one that he loved because of the faith that he had. The one that he loved because of being a champion for the things of God. Why would he stay with Saul all those years? Because he thought, brothers and sisters, that if he left his father, it would bring shame to him. He chose to honor his father, even though he didn't respect the decisions his father was making. There's a commandment in the Bible, isn't there, to honor your parents and you will have long life. To honor somebody just means to seek to build a good name for them. That's what the word honor means. Jonathan sought to build a good name for his father. Did Jonathan's father earn Jonathan's honor? There was nothing to respect in this man. And yet he could still seek to build a good name for his father, even though his father did nothing to earn his respect. And so Jonathan made a decision that he was going to stay with his father. He thought perhaps too that he could help his friend David best in this circumstance. When we turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 31, we see the consequence of the decision that Jonathan made and how far he was willing to go in order to honor his father. Could I please have someone read 1 Samuel chapter 31, verses 1 to 4? Yes, nice and loud, please. So there's the consequences of Jonathan's decision to honor his father. In the end, Saul watched his sons die before his eyes. And when he's mortally wounded, with his last words, he finally gets a right perspective. "Draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith," he says to his armor bearer, "lest these uncircumcised..." He finally has developed a little bit of spiritual perception. "Come and thrust me through and mock me." He's still concerned about his pride at the end of his life. And you know, even David would honor this man, upholding the same spirit that Jonathan did. There was an opportunity that David had to kill Saul while Saul was chasing after him for 10 years. On two occasions, David spared his life, and instead of killing him, used the opportunity to preach to Saul and to try to convert him. And so we see a man that deserved no honor, but was held up in esteem and was held by those who sought to build a good name for him, both in Jonathan, his son, and David, his servant. And so we learn that honor is not dependent on the person. Honor is something we show regardless of how the person acts. It doesn't mean that we respect what the person does or that we agree with the words they speak or the actions they take. It simply means we seek to build up a good name for them. And if rebuke is needed, which was done by Jonathan, which was done by David, let it be done in private with love and respect. And if mistakes are made by them, use the opportunity to build up and not to tear down. You know, the passage we quoted from at the beginning in Hosea chapter 13, verse 11, which said, "I gave thee a king in mine anger," concludes, "and I took him away in my wrath." Thank you for your attention and participation, and we'll see you tomorrow, God willing. And it's...